The best way I describe it is I use the analogy of the Space Jam movie. So there's a scene in that movie where the enemies, the monsters, get this magic basketball and then they trick NBA players to touch this magic basketball. And all of a sudden, these high-level athletes, their shooting goes away, their powers go away, their ability to jump and dunk goes away. They go into hospital just to see how they can get better again. And for me, once depression starts, all of the things that make up my personality and who I am, and you said I was a good bloke before, part of that is my conversation ability and being able to talk to people, all of that stuff goes away. So when you are hit with the normal challenges of life, your skills that are usually up here then go down here because they've been stripped away.
But Tim, thank you very much for joining us today on the lived experience. Now you're back for the third time, which is fantastic. So appreciate you coming back, and you're coming back on because we had a chat, and it's for a reason. I think it's a really important conversation to have. I don't know if I've heard many people speak about what you're going to talk about today online, but it is a very common thing with bipolar disorder, from my understanding as well. So do you want to just kick off first with Tim a bit about what's been going on and why you wanted to come back on and chat about what's been going on today?
Yeah, of course. So I spent the last 11 months in a depression cycle. It was 11 months of really tough times, really bad thought processes, really bad habits. It was triggered by the loss of my dad, but then compounded by other things that stop due to a life stoppage for a while. And yeah, I've been on three times now. I'm a serial offender, and so thank you for having me back. But I think the thing with bipolar, both one and two, is you will have times, quite simply put, where you're doing great, and then you're going to have periods of time where you're not doing great. And I think to be able to document that three times of you is pretty special, because what we'll get into is once you're on the back end of recovery with depression, mental health, bipolar, manic disorder, there are some incredible insights that can be gained, not only to improve your own well-being going forward, but hopefully myself, by sharing it today, I can help someone else in the same spot too. If it's just one person, that's what this is for today. And also to give myself a blueprint for next time if this happens.
Mm. Now, my mum had a trigger. There's multiple triggers, but the one trigger which always was a big problem was if there was a death of a friend, family, relative, whatever it was, right? And this happened multiple times. And as soon as there was a death in our family, she's come from one of 11, there's a large number of family members, even a friend, I instantly knew there might have been, it was 3 or 4 weeks and then she would go manic, and then, you know, she'd be in the psychiatric ward. So that was happened when her father passed away, and that happened when her brother did, and a few other times as well. So it seems to be like it's a trigger for, like, it's true, remote. Like, you know, I lost my mum as well a couple of years ago. I just know a couple of years ago, and I don't have any mental health challenges, but it really, you know, it's a real big kick in the guts for anyone. And then you chuck in there someone who's got a complex mental health condition, putting that in that frame as well, you know, it can be very, very devastating. And I feel a lot of sympathy for people who have those challenges and also have to deal with certain things like that, because it's a really hard event to deal with in a normal circumstance. So how did it, like, obviously your father meant a lot to you. You're close with your dad, and, you know, as you can tell from a lot of people from meeting him, you're a good reflection of your parents and you're a great bloke. So I never met your dad, but I'm sure he was a great fella, and it obviously hit you really, really hard, like it would most people. So talk us about Once that's happened, like, is it something where it's just straight away, it's like a downward spiral, or you just find yourself in a bit of shock still, and then maybe 3 to 4 weeks later, how's that whole thing happen?
The thing that you mentioned there is, like, a death in the family is hard for anyone, let alone someone with a preconditioned mental health, complex mental health disorder. And it can actually be one of those things that your mind does put a bit of negativity on you. I have a twin brother and I have an older sister, and we all grieved around that same 2 to 3 month mark. But then, for lack of a better word, due to their jobs, they had to kind of get back to reality in a sense and still grieve through that process. But because I had a business, there wasn't anyone forcing me to go back to work. It was all on me. And therefore, when the mental health came into it, and then said, nah, we're not ready. You then look at your twin brother, you look at your older sister and go, well, they're back. Okay, why am I not? And yeah, you can say, well, it's because I have a mental health condition, but your mind doesn't accept that. Your mind says they're already better, so to speak. Why are you not better? And it hasn't only been until now that I've accepted, well, I had a different path, and they are still grieving on their journey as well. So I'm not discounting what they're going through, and if they're listening as well, which I know they would be. It's more to do with what happened was dad lost. Then you have there's no normal grieving process, but you'd have your month or 2 months out where the world would be, okay, it's okay that you're not responding, but then you know, even the person that passed isn't going to want you to stay down for very long. So what happened for me was when I needed to get going again, my brain didn't let me do that this time. And instead of that, it retreated and we found ourselves in the spiral of depression again.
Now, the spiral of the depression, can you describe it for people? Because I still don't think a lot of people, we say the term depression, a lot of anxiety, and it's one of those things where you can just, it's hard to make someone who doesn't experience it know truly what it is. You know, words is one thing, but the other person trying to feel it. So can you try and use your best description of what that feels like to someone who might struggle to feel the same way?
The best way I describe it is I use the analogy of the Space Jam movie, not the new one, not the LeBron James one, not the bad one. Okay, the Michael Jordan one back in the 90s. It's actually decent. Right. So there's a scene in that movie where the enemies, the monsters, get this magic basketball, and then they trick NBA players to touch this magic basketball, and all of a sudden these high-level athletes, their shooting goes away, their powers go away, their ability to jump and dunk goes away. They go into hospital just to see how they can get better again. And for me, once depression starts, all of the things that make up my personality and who I am, and you said I was a good bloke before, part of that is my conversation ability and being able to talk to people, all of that stuff goes away. So when you are hit with the normal challenges of life, your skills that are usually up here then go down here because they've been stripped away. So for me, it is a complete lack of function in everyday ability, so that when normal stress comes at you, you can't deal with it. So someone might send me a text message like yourself. You did message me. You said, Tim, what's going on? Because you knew, you've had lived experience. You knew something would happen. I saw that message, but then didn't have the ability to respond to that message. In a healthy mindset, it's not a hard message to respond to. Hey, Joel, thanks, mate. Thanks for checking in. Look, I am doing a bit tough at the moment. I'll be in touch soon. But instead, my brain looks at it and goes, oh, no, I haven't been on social media in 3 months. I haven't been thing. If I click on this now, someone will see I'm active and there's the retreating thing. And all of that compounds into I see Joel's message, but I can't respond to it. Yeah, that's what it feels like. It feels, to sum it up again, it just feels like all of your skill sets go away and the only thing you can do is retreat, is go to bed and avoid the world.
Sorry to interrupt, mate, but how did those around you understand when this was happening? Because obviously you got a wife now, and you would have friends and family who know you very well. So when this retreating is going on, what in your opinion is the best thing for those around you in regards to what they can do? Because it would be very frustrating for them as well on their end in regards to seeing this happen. What, from your perspective, can people do in that scenario?
They could almost do absolutely anything, but it won't create an impact until the person who is sick takes the responsibility to accept the help, lean into the help, and then do the actions that it takes for you to get better. So I had about 5-6 people come over to my house this time, amazing individuals, and they all helped in ways that they knew how to help. One lady actually cleaned the dishes that were empty in the sink. Another mate took me out on a walk. Another friend sat me down and looked at all of the business tasks that I had to do. And he said to me at the time, he said, "Tim, this is only 2 weeks worth of work. You know, you can get on top of this." But I didn't get on top of it because I wasn't well. And so I had people come and help in all manners of ways this time, because not only now was it just mental health, but people knew that I'd lost my dad and lost him too young. I'm 29 years old. You don't usually be a 29-year-old and without a father. So a lot of people helped this time, but it wasn't until a critical mass point where I was able to receive that help. So what they can do to answer the question is hang in there with you, understand, say, "Hey, I'm here to support you. I'll do whatever you want." Yeah, come visit, come over to the house, because that stuff really does kick you out of it and that really does help. But it wasn't until the 10, 11 month mark where finally there was an intervention from family. Finally, people kind of went, "Tim, we understand grief, we understand loss, we understand depression, but it's been 11 months. You need to start doing the activity." Because I started covering up things. I started to get into behaviors that are really not appropriate. You know, my wife asked, we were doing an activity, and this was like goal setting activity. And it was like, "What do you want? How are you going to achieve it? Who wants you to do it? And then where are you going to get there?" The only thing I wrote down on that bit of paper was, "I want to be myself again." And I didn't even know how to get there. It was like, "What do you want? I just want to be myself again." The idea of that exercise is to create 5, 6, 7 things, but that was the only thing I could think of. And Lisa could see that I was struggling with this exercise. And she said, "Have you been seeing your psychologist?" To which I said, "Yes," because your brain doesn't want the argument. And I'd told my psychologist to actually, if I don't keep up with these appointments, the last time I met with her, I was like, "If I don't keep, I know that it's bad. So if I don't keep up with appointments, you have authority to call Lisa." So Lisa asked me, "Have you been seeing the psychologist?" And I said, "Yes," because I just didn't want to go down the path of, "Oh, you're not doing that," all that stuff. Anyway, literally 5 or 10 minutes later, we're sitting in the same room. Lisa's phone rings. Well, I get a missed call from the psychologist, but I flip it over on my phone. Her phone then rings. "Hey, I'm Tim's psychologist. I haven't been in touch with him." Then Lisa goes, what's going on? "You've told me one thing, I've done the other." So that can be quite dangerous when it comes to mental health. Sometimes people will say they're doing one thing and then not do the other. And it started to become behavior that just isn't me, but it's the depression doing that. And I think that, although that was critical, because that started the intervention. That was the point at which all motivation is the difference between where you are and where you want to be. And when that tension gets tight enough, you actually do the activity. So it wasn't until that point where I hit pretty much rock bottom, lying to you, know, covering things up, and that things had to change. And I know that's a very roundabout way of you ask me what can people do, but I think the answer is it's a combination of them helping and then the recipient of the mental health, or the person with the mental health challenges, actually accepting help.
What do you think stops you from accepting help? Then is it the chemical imbalance in the brain at the time, or what was it? What do you think actually stops someone accepting the help? Even though when you probably deep down know you need it, but like, is it just the mental illness? You think that it's just saying otherwise, or what do you think's happening there?
Well, there'd be loads of things, and I can only speak from my personal experience, but the first one would be, yeah, the chemical imbalance in the brain. It's like, even if they give me the help, I don't even know if it's going to work. The second one is you don't want to be a burden. When you're depressed, you think you are a burden on people, which is just an absolute lie to yourself. You're never a burden on people, although sometimes when you're depressed, you truly believe that. And you think that by asking for help that you'll be a burden, and that's completely incorrect, but that's what you feel. That's what I felt. I didn't want to be a burden. And then the last one for me specifically is throughout my life, I have struggled to ask for help. It doesn't matter if I'm sick or well. It's a Beanland trait, actually. My passed down from my grandpa and my dad, and we just, it's like, no, I can do this myself. And that's just such, it's not a good way. Like, yeah, okay, be resourceful, be independent, but not to the point of self-destruction. And when it comes to not accepting help from others that when you absolutely need it and you're self-sabotaging, especially when it comes to treatment of bipolar and mental health, for me, it's this time around was very much an acceptance that there's help out there and you need to lean into it. Why I hadn't accepted it in the past was, yeah, the chemical imbalance, you think you're a burden, and just stubbornness. I can get out of this myself.
Well, the burden thing, I'm glad you raised that, because that's a really good point. A lot of people connect with my mum in the psychiatric ward and stuff who ended up ending their life. You know, a lot of the times, you know, I don't know how many times, if it was true or not, but she, you know, she'd say, oh, you know, I read the letter, or why did they do it? And a lot of the time the word burden did come up. You know, they thought they were going to be a burden on their families or just a burden to society. And that's a lot of the time the final thought of thoughts or their reasoning for their decision, because a lot of people are really cynical and say, you know, oh, you know, people who end their life, it's real selfish. You know, it's a real selfish thing to do and all that sort of stuff, right? Whereas the other side of it is that that person's mindset is just they think they're such a burden to the world and that the world would be better off without them, that they unfortunately choose to do that decision. And we obviously know that no one is a burden to the world. And I'm almost getting my head on a bit with marketing, but you almost think, you know, you're not a burden. It's a great tagline to put in mental health, but, you know, that's something.
100%. There's a Jordan Peterson clip going around, and I'm going to do my version of what he says. And he says, don't underestimate the hole that you will leave if you decide to go down the suicide path. Don't underestimate the trauma that you will leave if you go and do that. Don't underestimate how hard it will be for the people that love you, that actually love you, that you think you're a burden on, if you go and make that final decision, the hurt that that will actually cause them. And, you know, he goes on to tell a story of a client and a patient that he actually had. He has patients come to him after their family have committed suicide. And one of these patients was, one of the clients missed a phone call an hour before the person decided to end their life. And how on earth do you recover from that? How on earth do you, you know, if only I wasn't working, if only I wasn't doing that shift. And this is something Jordan Peterson says, and that's just such a heavy thing. And the ending of your life is such a final solution to a temporary problem that at the time we think isn't a temporary problem. I can tell you, I went through financial hardship this time around. I went through a business stoppage. I'm not calling it a failure anymore. It's a stoppage. My uncle pulled me up on the last podcast that I was on. I said it was, but it's not. It just was frozen. But because it was such a built thing in an identity, I thought that I could no longer do business anymore. And that was sad. But that phrase of ending your life is a permanent solution to a temporary problem is just so true. When you're in it, you don't realize that, though. You think the temporary problem is a permanent problem, and that's why you decide that that's the option. And we do that pretty selfishly because we don't realize the pain that we're going to leave if you end up going and doing it.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, to have that, well, everything you said there is spot on, but I think, you know, for people in, you know, if they might have a mental health condition, yeah, just the mind's never going to really work to have that other empathetic, let's say, mindset to have that perspective, which is why it's such a really big problem, right? We know that everyone's, you know, that person is never a burden to anyone.
No matter how unwell. Yeah. I mean, you're unwell, and your brain is the biochemistry of your brain is telling you that, is telling you that's the way to do it. And you know, that's the illness. I guess that's maybe how the illness gets you, right? So cancer gets you in a particular way. A heart attack gets you because it stops your heart. Depression gets you because your brain tells you that the final solution is the answer. And when you're out of that, you know, the amount of people that, and we're getting into pretty heavy stuff, so I know you're doing your top, but the amount of people that, like, I've heard this stat, almost 100% of people, if they were to decide to go off a bridge, the moment that they make that jump, they regret it instantly. And all survivors of those type of attempts, they all say that. They all say as soon as they make that jump, they regret it. So if that's the case, why does it still happen? Well, I'm not a psychiatrist and psychologist. So I'm not qualified to even go into the depths of that. But I do have lived experience, and I know that if you're down and out and you are in the pits of it and you think that you're a burden and you think that what you've done and what has happened is so incomprehensible, that seems like the only way out. It's, we all know it's a tragedy. So, yeah, you might have to put a trigger warning at the start of this episode.
Yeah. Trigger warning, you know, people, we need to deal with reality, right? And this is a reality of life, if people like it or not, unfortunately. So yep. It's something that goes on a lot, and it's something that seems to come in waves still. You know, I think mental health movement, as you would know, comes in and out, and it's sort of out at the moment. You know, there's a cost of living crisis and stuff like that, so that sort of seems to be taking all the...
The one thing that really annoyed me is I got better around men's mental health month. I was recovered. So here we go. Let's have a look. You know what I saw? I saw people doing jumping jacks on LinkedIn for mental health. Yeah. I saw people running around doing exercise. And you know what? Mm. It's been 2 months later, and none of these people have probably even given a thought about it.
Mm.
And
I'm glad you didn't swear then. I thought you were going to swear.
No, it's because. You know, good on you. You think you're doing the right thing. Mm. But I can tell you there's people doing those jumping jacks that weren't there to support me. There were some of them, there were some of them that were supporters. But it's very funny how they'll do something like that because we think it's helping. And we're told to because it's Men's Mental Health Month. So we'll do something. And I'm not saying that if you were one of these people doing jumping jacks that you shouldn't have done it. I'm just saying that, have you put much forward into it since then? And it's not just mental health or Men's Mental Health Month. It's all the time. It's constant. It's not one day, one month, one week. These months are great for awareness, but, you know, it's borderline hypocrisy. Would love yeah. your, you know.
I could go on it for an hour. Like, you know, to yeah. me now, you know, you might, this is a little bit unrelated, but like to me now, you know, there's obviously LinkedIn personal branding and a big LinkedIn, the LinkedIn personal brand post I always see, which is someone taking a selfie talking about their one time maybe they had a bit of mental struggle in their life and doing it for a bunch of, you know, likes and comments and stuff, which is really disingenuous. And them saying they're a mental health advocate or something, it's just like, oh, yeah. It's very disingenuous, and I think it's something, unfortunately, that mental health, you know, a lot of people take advantage of it now to try and build personal brands with online. You've got no idea about it, and it's,
The problem is the communication is not coming from the people with lived experience. It's coming from the people that are a step aside, and that's fine, but then it lacks context. It lacks the actual experience that you've had with your mum, that I've had in personal circumstances. So if someone comes to me and says, are you okay? And I'm depressed. I can just say yes. I can just say yes. And that's the problem with a lot of men, especially with mental health, is we will just mask it. And how do you get that person with a mental illness to actually talk up about it? Well, I think it's about things like what we're doing today and having more people like myself and you talking about the lived experience. And it's why I've been a fan of coming onto the show 3 times. You're doing something that's actually practical here, Joel.
So, but also think about talking about real stuff as well. Like for me, like, you know, it's hard to consume mental health content all the time as well, because I keep seeing the same thing, which is like, it's great to see. I see a lot of guys who do, I don't know the names of them, but there's some podcasts and some blokes talking about, generally about depression and anxiety or separations and stuff, which is really, really tough stuff, but it's really, really commonplace. But it's generally be the same stuff. For me, the stuff that I really think needs to be talking about is the stuff we've just spoken about regarding end of life. I think that's a big thing. I know it might be uncomfortable for people, but it's a big reality of life. It's a main killer of men under 40, right? So,
well, it's the end point. It's the end point of depression. It's the it's how it, I like that phrasing. It's how it gets you. Your cancer gets you by killing your entire body. Your heart attack gets you by stopping your heart. Your brain tumor gets you by stuffing your brain. Your depression gets you by making that final decision. And that's the illness part of it. So how do we treat the heart attack? Well, we eat better and we exercise. How do we treat the mental health? Well, ironically, we also eat better and we exercise as well. That helped me.
But also I think talking about more as well about things like we don't hear like psychiatric wards, the treatment that is involved, like ECT, convulsive therapy, and long-term things, what goes on with that. Because I think they're important things as well, because there's a lot of people, you know, might refer to something as the loony bin or psychiatric ward and not know actually what goes in those sorts of joints. And sort of the people who work in those places as well, I think, do a really good job. Mental health nurses, for example, they don't get nowhere near the amount of attention as, or kudos as maybe, let's say, the general nurse would, but they do a really, really good job and they're really, really patient people. So the ins and outs of the psychiatric system as well. And I'll give you an example, like, you know, people might not know, but those, you know, my mum was in a, was in psychiatric wards, and a lot of the time that they had to get rid of people, you know, you couldn't, it wasn't a holiday there sometimes, so you had to get them out. And then unfortunately, a lot of those people were released too early, then ended up going on and, you know, ending their life, you know, and there's no accountability for the services on those sorts of things. So these are the things that people, you know, don't probably know about, but probably need to be discussed a bit more. And I love interviewing people back from the 80s and the 70s and stuff when it wasn't really something that was spoken about, but a lot of households knew what went on. And you had more traditional sort of places and treatments. But
I mean, that's the privilege that I've had is, yes, okay, we slagged off Are You Okay Day, we slagged off Mental Health Month a little bit, right? But the fact that they're there means that we have progress.
Absolutely.
It means that the conversation is at least there. So these people doing jumping jacks online, when I go to them and I say, yeah, I've had a mental health condition, if they're nothing but supportive, it goes counteractive to what they put out personally online. And the benefit that we live in 2023 with mental illness is that conversation is much more wider than it was back in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And I feel very privileged to be able to be in a time period where that discussion is much more healthier. Can it be better? Of course, everything can be better. But I think, you know, I did one podcast before this, and the amount of people that told me you were brave or courageous for speaking up, and that was very nice of everybody to say that. But it's, for me, it wasn't a second thought. The conversation is so wide at the moment. Why not have more lived experience out there? And that's a great thing that, you know, and to give someone confidence when they are going through this, maybe for the first time. The conversation, because it's so much better, if you're going through a mental health crisis for the first time at the moment, you can be even more reassured that you're not alone. And I know that's cliched, but it's 2023. The conversation is so much wider. And if you could reach out to 2, 3, 4 people, and there'll be at least one degree of separation between someone that's gone through a similar or not the same thing.
It is wide though, Tim, but I reckon as well for me, I still don't think bipolar and schizophrenia. I'm trying to think, there'll be other conditions like, you know, BPD and stuff.
BPD, yeah.
That don't get the same.
Dyslexia.
Yeah. Dyslexia, I think I've started hearing a bit more about ADD and ADHD, which is good, because I think that's we're learning more in autism as well, and in women as well, especially something that's not really known about, but it is quite prevalent. But I think there's conditions like bipolar and schizophrenia, especially that I know of, that I still think it's very taboo and it's not spoken freely. And that might be because of it affects a smaller percentage of the population, which it does, but I do not hear it. I don't see many podcast clips of someone talking about bipolar or schizophrenia or psychic.
Every time I talk about bipolar, when I say I've got bipolar, I have to then follow that up with, oh, by the way, it's bipolar 2. And there's two types of bipolar. There's bipolar 1, which is what people stereotypically think it is, which is up and down, up and down, up and down. And then there's bipolar 2, which is characterized more by lengthy periods of depression and then an ability to go up a little bit higher. Now, myself, I've dealt more with those lengthy depression periods. And then there's been one or two hypomanic episodes where I was only in hospital overnight. So, cool. That's great. But why do I have to explain that? You know, why do I have to, why do I feel the need to tell someone that it's not bipolar one, it's bipolar two? I don't know. I think that's because of everything that you just said.
And it's, yeah. I certainly think people freely speak about it too much, to be honest. You know, was it 1.5% of the population or 2% or whatever have it? And I don't think it's still, I still think it's not spoken about nearly as freely as what some, let's say, depression or anxiety, just because depression and anxiety is more prevalent. But I think it's obviously up to people to whether they want to talk about it or not. But it's not overly in the conversation with those other conditions as well that I've been hearing over much. I've noticed a bit with autism actually now, which has been really, really good. I think that's a great thing that's slowly been more, let's say, people more familiar with that, like terms on the spectrum and all those different things. Whereas I think these other things are just not to the level that they just seem to be really forgotten about.
Again, that's why it's even more important for you to keep doing this podcast. I know you've got a very strong purpose behind why you started it, but you're one of only a few resources that I actually have as someone with bipolar to point people towards. And that's just, you know, I don't think I actually ever told you that in person or, you know, but you're one of the only resources that I've actually used to go, hey, listen to this, or talk to people. When I describe your podcast, I say, well, Joel set this up because his mum had bipolar and he wanted to bring a voice to the more niche, so to speak, mental illnesses, the dyslexia, the schizophrenia, the bipolars, the ADHDs. And it's great, the conversation for depression and anxiety is out there, but let's start talking about the other ones too.
But it's also more as well, like, Tim, to show yourself as a really good example of someone who's really, really smart, you know, and you've got a business. It's more as well just to show you don't have to be a victim towards that, because I think now especially victimhood almost in a way is sort of, it's celebrated, or it's tolerated. People put your arm around you, and rather than sometimes you just need a bit of, you know, an example to follow, right? So, you know, despite this person having this, look at what they've gone and done. That's why I like chatting to people like yourself and other people on the podcast who disclose their mental health challenges and who are really successful people, because I think that's really, really important.
I'm no longer, apart from the last 30 minutes of saying and classifying it as mental illness because everyone is watching, the bipolar 2 that I have is not a mental illness. It's actually a mental advantage when treated and used properly. So depression gives you a level of learning, knowledge, lessons, insights into yourself that a lot of people don't get. A lot of people don't get that stepping away from life for a long time and then coming back and realizing, well, I've lost everything. I've got a choice as to what I bring back into my life now. There's this really cool point when you come out of depression. So the down point's here and then you're coming up where it's like you're healthy again and you can then choose who you bring back into your life, what you bring back into your life and what you actually enjoy and love doing. And hey, why did it fail or why did it go wrong this time around? If I didn't want to continue my business again and go off and doing knitting somewhere, I could have done that. Probably my wife would have thought that was a bit strange, but it just so happens I love what I do and a lot of people are the same. And understanding that and having that insight is such an incredibly powerful thing. On the flip side, the mania gives you a level of drive, energy, passion, creativity, motivation, influence over things and people that other people can't tap into either. I mentioned if someone has that ability to kind of, and you've probably seen it in your mum, right? If someone had that ability to harness that manic energy with a healthy baseline, you'd be unstoppable. Like, you don't have to eat, you don't have to sleep, you don't have to, you know, don't have to eat, don't have to sleep. Ideas coming out your brain from everywhere. All you need is that practical grounding and implementation, and you're gonna go very far. The problem with mania is the ideas become flight of ideas. It's all over the place. The no sleep becomes non-productive because now you don't think you're tired, but you are tired. The things that you're actually doing, you think you're being productive, but you're just going around in circles. So those are the downsides. But if you can flip that into the advantage, I will go on record and say I do not do this every single time. And it's very dangerous to do this. But if I have to work until 1 a.m. or 2 a.m., I just don't take my medication and I don't have to sleep. Like, I can just power stuff out. Now, people say you got 24 hours in a day. That's sort of a lie. You've got 10 and then you go to sleep. Now, if you've got an ability to push that and push that healthily, healthfully, right, that's an advantage. If I can work two more hours than my competition, I'm going to be ahead. I will preface that by saying I do not do that every single time. That's going to concern, that is going to strongly concern some people. And I do not do it now because messing around with your medication is not a thing you should be doing. Like, that's a strong no-no. I'm just saying that look at what you have, not as a mental illness, but as a mental advantage. What are the things inside your illness that actually give you strength? And for me, it's the insights, reflection, knowledge, and then the passion, energy, motivation, and drive.
That's a great way to look at it. And I was going to ask you then, from someone who started, you said some really good stuff there about you started from scratch pretty much again. You had a pretty successful business going there for a while, and then you obviously this has happened, and you've had to start from scratch again. So how did you choose what to bring back in your life? Or because a lot of people might just go, I need to get money, I need to just get going again and take everything back on, and then away they go. So how did you restrain yourself from maybe doing that? And then how did you assess what you were going to bring back in?
It's very hard, because when you get out of depression, you want to catch up and you want to get going straight away, and you just want to go, I'm bang, a bullet a gate. I'm back. Let's do this. And someone looking at me online could probably see that I'm doing that a little bit at the moment, flying interstate everywhere, right? But I've had great help from Victor Tavishian, Martin Beanland, and Simon Bowden, all three of which have been pushing me in the positive direction and pulling me back when I needed to be pulled back. So when I recovered, the goal was reach back out to the business contacts that you need to, in terms of the people that I owed work to, and then also reach back out to the A-plus players, the people that you know you love working with, the people that you've worked with in the past, and let's see if we can just get some work going. And for me in particular, it was get to the wedding. So it was 3 months out before the wedding when that psychologist call came in to my wife, and at that point, it was like, you're not going to be there mentally. You'll be there physically for the wedding, but you won't be there mentally. So the goal was to just get to the wedding and let's just start responding to some of these people. And with the help of Victor, Martin, and Simon, I devised a plan. We got that list done. But then we also reached out, and you're asking, so how did I rebuild again? Well, I reached out to the people that knew me in business and knew what had happened. And from a marketing perspective, I also knew they needed videos because I'd been missing for 11 months. So the best one was one of my clients in Sydney, Steve. He'd messaged me about a microphone. He was like, you know, I want a microphone or something. And this was months ago. And then I called him up. I said, Steve, did you sort that microphone out? He's like, oh, yeah, I didn't even need it. It's okay. And he's like, this is funny. I've been wanting to do videos. And Tim, I was about to send you a message. But now that you're on the phone, what are you doing? You come up to Sydney. And that was the first job that I had, proper paid job, was actually flying up to Sydney and doing the work. And that came about by just reaching out to the people that I knew would respect what I do and also understand the story. Because for me going forward, picking the clients that, and this is why doing stuff like this is important, because picking clients that understand this happens and understand that I not only have a solid plan now to get through it, that's a big sort of tick box in terms of the type of people, because there's people that out there that don't understand, and that's okay. They're going on their own thing. But
and when they what do you mean by that?
Oh, I mean people that don't understand are people that will quickly try and move the conversation on. So you tell them what happened, and instead of sitting with you with it, they just move the conversation on. Now, there's probably two reasons why. I guess one, someone just might be uncomfortable talking about it, so we can't just write them off, but they will just care about themselves. And those are the people that don't really understand, I believe. Yeah. Have you had similar experiences? I mean, we don't want to harp on negative too much, but
Not in regards to me, no, because I don't really share too much in regards to at a one-on-one level with what's going on. I'm all business. So if I'm in a business environment, I'm pretty all business.
I must say that question was hard to answer because I have had blanket majority of people have been positive and understanding. So blanket majority, fantastic. Only two people so far have been tricky.
But let's just put that in perspective. That's the point I was trying to sort of pretty much make, is most people are generally good with this sort of stuff, you know. And if you disclose and tell people the full situation and don't hide it, most, if you're a decent human being, you've got empathy at some level. Most people do. If you don't, that's another story, but some people do and they're going to understand it. So was it in the message, did you just send something outlining where you've been, or was it just more of just a check general hey, or how'd you
it was a full update. It was full update. It was hey.
So that's important though. I think you've been transparent and you've disclosed something personal, and as we would know, most 99% of people will have a heart, will respond well to that.
The best response that I got back from people was this was the majority of people. It was, first of all, I'm so glad to hear from you. I was worried. Better communication next time would be great. So that, fair enough. fair enough. <Yeah. laughs> But hey, let's finish this project. You know, that's fine. Let's finish it. I'm lucky, and you know what we do, because you're very much ingrained in the Teams group, and it's like, if someone misses videos, it's not like, it's not the end of the world, but it's, a lot of them were actually appreciative. A lot of them said, you know what we planned, my business has actually moved on. So I love the fact that I didn't actually talk about that. So let's just film. And that was great. The majority of people were like, this is fantastic. I love the process. Let's finish the project. You know, only two people were just, you know, difficult. And that's just, you know, I'm not going to go into what they did or said or whatever, but they know who they are. I'll tell you off camera.
Yeah, that's so good. But, like, for me, like, at the moment, where do you see, just beyond moving the conversations, what can happen? Because I think a lot of people who do, you mentioned the things on LinkedIn and stuff, and I think, look, most people generally think, I want to show that I'm all for mental health. Mental health is important to me, whether it actually is or not, another story, but I just want to either get the engagement online and give some money to an organization where 80% of it's going to go to administration and 20% is going to go to maybe doing something, you know. So what do you think in regards to moving forward? Because I think now it's getting lost a bit. Obviously, new cycles about interest rates and mortgage stress, which in turn is going to have a mental health effect. You're going to have a lot of people on disability pensions and in commission homes and stuff, and their pensions aren't going up by the same rate that the food is going up, and they're really relying on, you know, the food banks and all that sort of stuff. You know, I know my mum, you know, now if we were around, we would be in big strife. The pension would not support us. But that sort of seems to be getting lost at the moment. I don't think it's been really mentioned too much. We're talking about people sleeping in cars and stuff, which is horrible. We're not talking about the flow-on effect it's going to have for mental health and in regards to the facilities as well. I presume they're going to be pretty much chockers with people.
Well, what I would do to answer this question, what now? Okay, you said it perfectly about a year ago in a LinkedIn post. You said the time for awareness is over. Action is now the thing that needs to happen. We need to stop doing jumping jacks on LinkedIn, and we need to start doing action. Okay, what does action look like? Or action looks like the person with the mental illness or advantage, as I say, taking responsibility in asking help from at least one person. So the communication needs to be not on the people doing jumping jacks saying, are you okay? It needs to be on the education on the person with the illness. You know, if I break my arm, I'm not just going to sit here in bed going, someone come and help me with my broken arm. You need to take some responsibility on having at least one person. And a lot of people don't have a supportive network like myself, so I have to be very careful. But we do have, we're lucky enough in Australia to have the facilities of professionals. So be that an online thing, or be that going to your local GP, you're not going to get better until you understand that it requires help to get out of your depression or mental health. You're not going to do it alone. You're going to need someone And I think the communication in terms of action needs to be first on people like myself in understanding how you can take that action for you. Now, this isn't victim blaming. This is just what has actually worked for me with an actual mental illness. I didn't get better until I did the stuff. So the communication needs to be around what can that person do? And then the communication needs to be to their support network and check in that they're actually doing the stuff. So my uncle, how did I actually recover from this thing? Well, I got back on my medication properly, but that was going on for the whole 11 months. I started to go for a walk every single day. Depression's best friend is darkness. What I would do at the start of every day was I would wake up, it'd be 10 a.m. already. I would go into the ensuite that we have. I would shut the blind in the ensuite and close the door. And then I would shut all the blinds in my room. And then I would close the door, even though my dog was on the other side going, let me out, let me out, let me in. I want to jump on the bed. I'd close the door and then the room was in complete darkness for the entire day. The moment that I got sunlight in the morning by going on a walk every day, that's when I actually started to get better. So depression's best friend is darkness. So to get away from that depression is I got sunlight in the morning. Even in Melbourne, one of the most gloomy cities on earth, we actually have some sort of sunlight in the morning. So getting out in the sun, for me at least, helped so much. But doing that consistently and also having someone like my uncle and my doctors asking me, are you going for those walks every day? So for action to take place, we need the practical tools that will help us get better. So for me, it's exercise, getting back in touch with people, playing guitar again, playing sport again, getting active, and then, you know, actually doing something that I'm passionate and purposeful about. That's the recipe for me. For you, it might be something different. But then you need someone there, if you're fortunate enough to have a wife like I do, who will now check in on that stuff. Oh, Tim hasn't spoken to Rob in a while. Oh, okay, that's strange. Tim hasn't gone and hung out with someone. He hasn't done any filming lately. What's going on here? Is he just telling me that it's all online? But hang on, like at least every month he's up in Brisbane or Sydney. Like that's stopped. Why is that stopped? So questioning the changes in someone's behavior as well is also quite helpful. And those tools need to be given not only to the person with the mental illness, but also to the support network. And it's not about awareness. It's about those action points. And that's, I'm just speaking from pure experience here. So, you know, I know I've said some pretty tough things, but I needed the tough things for me to get better.
And also think if people have complex mental health issues, to use the NDIS. You know, you can get a package from the NDIS, you'll get assessed and stuff. And there's a lot of good support through the NDIS. There's a lot of, my mum had a really good caseworker who was with her for like, you know, 15 years and she was invaluable. Like, it was annoying. You know, my mum sacked her heaps of times, but she, you know, even when she was unwell, she was sacked all the time. But, what happened was, but that caseworker knew her so well. And then over the years when the NDIS packages got there, you know, she had a significant amount of money to get to people for nutrition and for gym and for someone just coming to visit her and take her out. All these things are available for people, especially with really complex mental health issues. If they're on a disability support pension, they can have access to these sorts of things. And a lot of people might crap on the government for different things, but I think the NDIS in regards to my family, especially with my mum towards the end, was really, really, really important. You know, there might have been a few bullets going on every now and again, but from what I saw from a support point of view, there was a lot of good stuff that was available, and it was well worth people, if they do have a complex mental health challenge and they are on disability support pension, if they don't have the ability to have a family or something, they might have a lot of people have it, might be alone, they might be an orphan and have no family and whatever, but they can use those NDIS resources. And also there are community groups with lived experience people. There's one called Finding North and stuff where they can jump on to a Zoom with people from all around Australia who all have maybe bipolar or schizophrenia. And they'll just talk, you know, and that community aspect's really, really important. So I think no matter what your circumstance is, you can have, you know, something in place which works for you. So you've got what works for you, which is fantastic. But if you are someone who does need that extra government support, the NDIS, what Bill Shorten done, I think, has been quite fantastic, to be honest. I'm not political either way, but I think, you know, just from knowing from first experience with how my mum used it and the amount of money she got from the NDIS, it was definitely, we're very lucky to live in Australia. Put it that way.
Yeah, well, everyone needs a baseline. Everyone needs a base because medication costs money. going and seeing psychologists, psychiatrists cost money. So everyone should have that ability to have access to these tools. And if that means you go on an NDIS or a Centrelink or a whatever the scheme is, that's great because you use that to get better. And the thing is, you if you don't have to, you don't stay there forever. You use that as a springboard and you use that to get better. And if that's the help system that you need to get better, don't feel ashamed to go and using it because that's why it's there.
And you're right. And the reality is it saves lives. It saves lives, you know, having that extra support there. It's not detrimental. It's only a positive sort of thing. And I think people don't realize that as well. Like they think, you know, there's organizations like Beyond Blue and Lifeline, that's all there is for mental health. There's a lot of places like Wellways, you know, half the workers at Wellways all have a mental health condition as well. So, you know, the person who came and took my mum out for a coffee or whatever had bipolar as well, and that was her job. And you know what I mean? So that's those sorts of organizations. There's a few of them. But that's where, for me, we can make a big impact is get rid of these top-level awareness charities, you know, which does the hotlines, to more of these other ones which are more grassroots and these community-based care and these things. In-home community care as well is a big one. That's a huge thing where you can keep people out of hospitals by trying to help them at their home as opposed to waiting till they get into the state when they need to get them. Yeah.
Do you ask every guest that question? Like what should we do after awareness? Have you, or at least not every, but
no, not everyone. Not everyone.
You've got at least 5-10 answers?
A little bit. I've asked more the people who I've spoken to who have bipolar disorder or have a complex mental health challenge. I ask them because I think it affects them the most. Or sometimes I ask young carers or people who have had a parent with that. And I've asked Brad McEwen as well because Brad McEwen's a Beyond Blue ambassador to him, and he was the one who did say that, you know, the time for talking's over and all that sort of stuff. So I got that from him a couple of years ago. Yeah, but that's more that. Yeah, I always ask because I just think it's very, you know, what more can be done besides what we're doing at the moment? Is it allocation of money to more grassroots organisations, or is it more awareness of other more different conditions? I don't know.
Yeah, I've just had an idea. I'll talk to you about it off camera.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. But the thing you mentioned then, it, like people will know that, like, I'm glad you said the basic stuff, you know, getting outside. I think you mentioned walking your dog as well before that was.
Yep.
You know, dog will lift anyone's mood, right? So
there was a point. So I had the intervention and family came in and they did everything they could. But then a Monday came around and Lisa went back to work. And there was this turning point between, am I going to take the action or am I just going to fall back into the pit of depression? And it was amazing because as soon as that happened, I told my dog, like, it was Sunday, Lisa, we were there. Lisa, I was like, I told the dog, we're going for a walk tomorrow. Because she hadn't been for a walk in a while. Anyway, so Lisa goes off to work and it comes to about 9 o'clock, 9:30, where I could have fallen back into that old pattern. And the dog comes running in, jumping up on the bed, going, "You said we're going for a walk. You said we're going for a walk." And I went for a walk, and that was the start of it. And then I called my uncle and I said, "I'm out." And Phoebe got me out. The dog got me out. So,
but at some point, like my mum had a full time, like it wasn't full time, but she had a nutritionist. She had a gym pass, exercise. Even though she didn't follow nutritionists or she didn't go to the gym overly much, but she thought, she'd always, "I'm eating well and I'm going to the gym." And I knew she wasn't, or I'm got to see my nutritionist and stuff. They're telling me this. I'm doing all these exercises, but it's those. They're there for a reason, right? They're things that people know they should do and they don't do it, and you've just got to be really ultra consistent with it. Like this, you know, I've got an app on my phone called Streaks. Now, Streaks, basically, I have different things which I like gamify it. Like if I don't gamify it, and I have it on my phone, and it has there basically walk 6,000 steps, gym, awesome. Listen to an audio book and stuff, awesome. And I've got to tick it off. And if I get real, feel weird.
I got Qantas. Qantas have an app where they give you Qantas points if you hit a certain amount of steps.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, it's awesome. It's all right, I'm going to get my Qantas points. Like, you get like 5 points or 10 points or whatever, but it adds up. You can then use that on groceries and...
Yeah, these are things which I think are
good. But that's gamify it, yeah.
Gamify it, yeah, exactly right. Find out what works for you and gamify it. But Tim, mate, thanks for jumping on.
You're welcome.
We'll leave that as there. And obviously, if people want to find out more about you, they can just check you out on LinkedIn, Tim Benland. Yeah. How many followers you got now? 7,000, 6,000?
LinkedIn's about the 4,000, TikTok's 4,500, but I've started a new one just to trial some things.
Cool.
Reach out to me on any platform. More than happy to have a conversation with you. If you say something that's super complex, and I will just push you to support, but in a supportive and encouraging way. So very much looking forward to anyone who wants to reach out, please do message me. I'm more than happy to listen and help. And Joel, thank you again for having me on for a third time. I think I need to extend the favor again. Have you been on my podcast yet?
Well, the Experts Blueprint.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was that. Yeah, it was ages ago.
Okay, well, come on again.
Yeah, okay. No, I appreciate your time, mate.
Thank you.
And I think that what we just done very unique content in regards to this space. I guarantee you, some of those things you said, I don't think would have been spoken about at all online. So looking forward to putting that out there and hopefully it helps people.
Me too. That's the
guy. Right. Thank you. So a big thank you to Tim Beanland for sharing his story and the lived experience. And if you want to share yours as well, head to livedexperiencepodcast.com and contact me via the contact form. Love to have you on. And I love sharing stories like Tim's. I just think it's such a good one to hear. It's such a good real life perspective on mental health. It's not the typical stuff you'll see a lot on now, which is fantastic, which is just depression and anxiety sort of stuff, you know, talking about bipolar and the depression which comes with that. And what actually happens to someone, it just hits at home how much more work we've got to do in this space and how much more work needs to be done in open conversations to sort of cover these areas. And big thanks to Tim for that. There's so much great content in that as well. If you do enjoy it or think it is valuable to someone, please share it. If you did like it as well, please leave a review. Until next episode, I hope you have a great week.